Well, what were your reactions to the chapter on a good translation?
Mixed emotions. I have the just the King James, but it has the International Standard, I think it is, in the parentheses, so it tells you another word, which would be the Hebrew, more correctly, maybe. But there are so many of them, it's kind of hard to... You need about four different Bibles than I do have, but it's kind of hard to... I like to run subjects, and so I pick a subject, and then I run through every passage, you know, a topical study.
It can be confusing there because there are so many different translations that are out there. Anybody else? Reactions to kind of this chapter?
Well, I thought it was a bit convoluted and confusing in the way that they went about it in some things. I understand his principle, but I felt like he was sort of beating a dead horse there part of the time. So.
Okay. Well, maybe we can make some sense of it. Maybe we'll make it worse. I hope we make some sense of it.
When I got through reading it, at the end of it, it kind of explained everything all together because they're very learned in Hebrew and Aramaic and the different ones. And so when they study it in the language it was written in, and they understand what they're saying, and we won't have any idea. I mean, we'll come out sometimes with the right answer anyway because we just take it for granted, I guess, or maybe what we've been taught, but a lot of the time it does work out, like we were talking about interpretation last week. So.
True. Well, let's try to get started, and hopefully we can kind of organize this so it will make sense. I think Jimmy makes a really good point. Most of us can't read the original language. And even if we could read Greek, we couldn't read Hebrew or Aramaic. I know at one point I had decided that I would try to learn the Hebrew language, or at least have enough Hebrew that I could use some of the lexicons that were available to me. And so the local synagogue offered free classes in the Hebrew language. Anybody could take them. So I signed up, went over to the first class, and I was in class with all these 8-year-old Jewish boys. Here I am, 35 years old, trying to learn the Hebrew language and feeling really dumb. And I tried my best. I got to just about the point where I could tell you the alphabet. And then things happened at church, and I had to drop that class, so I didn't get to continue. But learning a foreign language is just plain hard. That's all there is to it. I spent 4 years in high school trying to learn Latin, and I can conjugate verbs, and that's about it. That really makes you sound like a nerd when you go to football games and you sit in the stands and yell Latin endings. And yes, I actually did that. So there's the Bible that we can't read. And for the most part, we also have to contend with the fact that we don't have the original autographs, that the handwritten copy that the Apostle Peter actually wrote out by hand would be called the autograph. Now, we have autographs of some very important documents. We have the handwritten copy of the Declaration of Independence. It was, and the signers, we have the handwritten copy of the Constitution, the handwritten copy of some other instruments, but we don't have anything that even approaches a handwritten copy of what the apostles actually wrote. And even if we did, we wouldn't be able to read it because it was written in either basically Greek or Hebrew. There are three short sections in the Old Testament that are in Aramaic, but those sections are so short that for the most part, we can just say that it was written in either Hebrew or Greek. So we have to get to that's the Bible we can't read. So we have to deal with the Bible that we can read. And the Bible that we can read is a product of interpretation. We talked about that a little bit last week. We'll talk about that a little bit more this week. And then it's also the product of translation. So how do we deal with all of this stuff?
Very well.
Well, my conclusion has been that I find a translation that's a good translation, and we'll talk about what makes them good or bad. I find a good translation, and I read that one most of the time. And then I compare it to other translations. And whenever there's a difference or a variant, then of course I have to pay a lot more attention to figuring out what the Bible really says in that particular place, what the autographs really said. So using multiple translations can help to identify the author's interpretation decisions, and it will sometimes help with the translation decisions that the translators made. So at this point, go to page 3 where you'll see that text insert box, and I realize that Jimmy and Eldon can't see this because
I got a book.
Oh, you've got, that's right, you've got the
book.
So this text box that I included in the outline for tonight's discussion is a discussion of 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 36. The New King James translation, or the King James translation, says, if a man thinks that he is behaving improperly toward his virgin, or his virgin, then it gives him some direction. Well, that's a little bit ambiguous. We don't know really who that's talking about. Now, Stuart and Fee say that the way that the apostle wrote it meant that the people that received that letter knew what kind of a situation he was talking about. And if you look at some other translations, you can see that there are different ways of trying to figure out who the man is and who the virgin is. The New American Standard says, if any man thinks that he is acting unbecomingly toward his virgin daughter. So this would be a father and a daughter. And then the instructions follow. That's based on some information that we have. The New International Translation says, if anyone is worried that he might not be acting honorably toward the virgin he's engaged to, well, that's not the father and the daughter. That's a slightly different situation. And then you get some information that's given about how you're supposed to resolve that. The New English Bible, the NEB, says if any man has a partner in celibacy and feels he is not behaving properly toward her, that's a third situation. In this case, you have two people who are married, but they have decided to follow instruction and they're living separate, at least for the time. And so the instruction then follows. How do you resolve that? Well, Stuart and Fee come to the conclusion that Paul had one of those situations in mind and not the other two, and that he wrote this in a way that was not ambiguous, and the people that received the letter understood what he was talking about. Now, that's the concept of exegesis that we talked about last week. I have a slightly different take on this matter of exegesis. And remember, last week we talked about the fact that the Bible gives us timeless instruction for all men everywhere, and it also gives us instruction that's bounded by the historical situation and the cultural milieu in which this letter was received. Now, my conclusion is that if we translate this ambiguously, we have the Apostle Paul who is responding to a specific question, but he's doing it in a way that allows his answer to be applied as well to the other situations that are possible. What do you think?
I think if you read it in the context out of almost any, considering it's talking to the married and the unmarried and what they should do and what they shouldn't do, then he's talking to people who are not married, but perhaps engaged, quote, and so I think it stems from there. Keep it where it belongs. One says unseemly, and the other one says uncomely. So you kind of have to know what that means, or you're not going to get it anyway. So, I mean, it's not how we say it.
That's true.
We just say, he wasn't, he wouldn't want to, I guess unseemly is about right. He wouldn't want to be unseemly with the situation. And then he says, nevertheless, and he goes on and explains it a little bit more.
That's true. But I think it is important for us to consider what the Apostle Paul may have been responding to.
Yeah.
So they had apparently asked him a question, and Paul responded to the question. So we don't have a copy of the letter that they communicated to Paul, or the questions that they asked Paul. we're sort of stuck trying to figure out what the question they asked him was based on what his response was. So how do you know which Hebrew or which Greek text you want to follow? That, you know, it's not just that we can't read the autograph. If we had the autograph, we couldn't read it anyway. But which Greek text are we going to follow here in 1 Corinthians 7 at verse 36? Well, it turns out that around the turn of the 20th century, the early 1900s, up to the end of the 1900s, we discovered a lot of manuscript evidence that is not always consistent. We found the Dead Sea Scrolls. Of course, we had the Masoretic text that was put together by Masorite monks. That was an effort to try to figure out what the original text that was written really looked like. And we've had that for a long time. And we've had the Septuagint translation of the Old Testament for a long time. But when you find the Dead Sea Scrolls and suddenly you find intact copies of what was really close to the original autograph, and sometimes it differs from the text that we've been using, well, you have to modify your approach to what the text really said. So how do you do that?
Dean?
You look at two kinds of evidence. The first kind of evidence that you look at is the external evidence. And some of that is the age of the text that you have in front of you, where it came from. There was a tradition of careful copying that existed in Alexandria and in Egypt at around the time that these letters in their originals were circulating among Christians. There had been a library in Alexandria for many years. And of course, this predates having printing presses, and it really predates having computers. So these hand copyists would copy down what was in the original language. And we know that they were very careful about their copying. When they got to the bottom of the page, that had to be the bottom of the page that they were copying from. And we know that they went through a lot of steps to make sure that they had copied it properly. If the copyists of Old Testament documents made an error in their copying, they threw away the whole copy. They didn't just throw away that page. They didn't just cross it out and fix it. They threw away the whole copy, and they started all over again. So that's going to make you very careful to make sure that you don't make mistakes. Now, sometimes the copies that survived, unfortunately, were the ones that they threw away. And we know it has an error in it somewhere. So they counted the letters in each line. They sometimes counted the strokes that they had to make the letters in each line. They took great pains to be as accurate as they could. And in many cases, the evidence that they were accurately copying is very good. But there are some cases where it's pretty clear that there were errors. So then you turn to the internal evidence. And you basically compare different manuscripts. And how do you figure out which manuscript you're going to use as the basis for translation? Well, sometimes when you look at a manuscript and there's a difference in the way that things read, it's pretty easy to see how the error might have arisen. And he talks about 1 Samuel at chapter 8 at verse 16, where he says, the king will take your donkeys and your cattle, or your donkeys and your sons. Well, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for him to compare donkeys and sons. Would make more sense for him to compare donkeys and cattle. And when you look at the ease with which you could make that mistake, it turns out that cattle and sons are very, very close when you look at the words. And it might be explainable that they would make an error there. It wouldn't take much to make that error, and you would get donkeys and sons as opposed to donkeys and cattle. Sometimes copyists made errors. They didn't copy faithfully what they were reading because they had some underlying theological bias, and they didn't want it to be that way. Now, we don't find very many cases of that. Some would suggest that the fact that women have been, in many cases, eliminated from the record is copyists who took women out because it didn't fit their theological bias, that it should always be men who are recorded. Sometimes they make theologically biased errors, and it's really clear what they've done. If you read the Jehovah's Witness translation of the Bible, just reading beginning in John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was a God, in the Diaglot translation, which is the Jehovah's Witness translation. So they clearly put a word in there that's not in any of the original manuscripts, and they did it because of a theological bias. So you can get theological biases, and they use 1 Corinthians 6 at verse 20 as an example. Glorify the Lord in your body and in your spirit, which is the Lord's, as a case where there may have been a theological bias, and it may have changed the way that that was copied. So, all of that says is, when you consider a translation, you need to consider the source documents, what manuscripts were they translating from, and you need to be careful about what's included in those manuscripts. And Stuart and Fee suggest that one of the best ways to do that is to compare readings from other translations. And they suggest that you ought to look for translations where you expect to find a variant reading in the English, and then where you expect to find that variant reading, go back and do the research. Find out what original text they used, what manuscript they used to translate, and what the evidence is for the validity of that particular text. And that's all available. You can find that research online. Some translations put it right there in the introduction to the Bible. There's an introduction or translator's notes, and they'll tell you what text they translated from. If you go online and you look up the various translations and you spend a little bit of time with it, you can figure out what the original manuscripts that they used were. There's a fascinating descent of manuscripts that you can read about. If you'll search descent of manuscript evidence in Wikipedia, it will give you a beginning point for kind of understanding all of these different manuscripts. So that's all a field of science called textual criticism. In other words, you're trying to figure out the validity of the text. So they suggest that you get a translation that comes from a text, from a manuscript text, that incorporates the latest findings from archaeology. And those are growing, the number of manuscripts that we can use to compare is growing. And so they suggest as a beginning point, as something that you work with most of the time, that you use the New International Translation or the New International Version. There are other translations that are in that group, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. I will say that when I began preaching, I basically read the King James as my basic text, and then I compared other things to the King James translation. The King James translation was made on the basis of some pretty faulty textual evidence, because it was made in 1611, and we just didn't have many of the texts that have come to light since 1611. So the reason that I used the King James was most of the basic research material was all keyed to the King James translation. So if you wanted to look up a word, you had to look up the English word that was in the King James translation, and that would tell you what the Greek word came from. Now, we're not that limited anymore because we have the computer that can help us and guide us, but that was why I chose the King James translation. So most of my memory work I did in the King James translation. And even though I've, for many purposes, changed my basic translation, now I use the Holman English Bible. The Holman... I have to even look now to remember what that thing is called. It's the Holman Christian Standard Bible. It was published in 2003. That's the one that I use as my basic text, and I read that one most of the time. And I hate to admit it, but one of the reasons that I sort of settled on that one is because it was written and the translation was prepared in the biggest print that I could get on the most opaque paper. And so it's the easiest one for me to read when I don't have my reading glasses with me. So I hate to admit it, but that's a consideration in my case. I'm getting a little older, and I need a translation that I can read. Some translations became popular because they were generally available. The American Standard Translation never became very popular because it was copyrighted, and Holman closely held the copyright. They wouldn't let anybody else print it. It's not like the King James Translation. Everybody in the world prints, every printing house prints a King James Translation Bible. But not so with the American Standard Translation, because they, I think, they held that copyright so closely. They wanted to make a profit off of it, and that kept it from being very popular because nobody else could print the thing. It's a pretty good translation, but it just never kind of caught on because it was hard to find it. So, that's the text. That's the problem with what text are we going to translate? And then there's a whole different area when it comes to translation. And that's what Stuart and Fee called translation decisions or questions about language. And they say that you have to consider multiple ideas. The first idea that you have to consider is the original language. What language are you translating it from? So it's either going to be Hebrew, if it's Old Testament, a little bit of Aramaic, or it's going to be Greek, if it's New Testament. And then you have to consider what language you're translating into. And for the most part, we're concerned with translating from the Greek into English, because that's what we read. Now, I've talked to guys who preach in Spanish, and they say that there are as many problems with translations of the Bible into Spanish as there are with translations into English. I have a friend who speaks French, and he talks about translations into French. When I was preaching in Alaska, I encountered people that spoke, their native language was Yupik. Now we're talking about people that lived as far north as you can live in Alaska, up on the Arctic coast. And there aren't a lot of Yupik speakers, but it turns out when you consider how you're going to translate things into that language, that you have to be aware of the fact that they don't even have some of the concepts that we think about as being so fundamental. Like when Jesus says, consider the sparrows. They give no thought for the morrow, and God takes care of them. Well, they don't have a word for sparrow because there's no such critter in that region of the world. There are no sparrows in the Arctic. So how do you translate that? Well, the way that the translators came up with doing that is to translate it, consider the ducks. Because they have ducks, and they have a word for ducks. But they don't have sparrows, and they don't even have a word for sparrow. Now, they have 26 different words for snow, but they don't have a word for sparrow because there is no sparrow in Sparrow, Alaska. So you have to consider the receiving language or the receptor language, the language you're translating into. And you have to consider the historic differences or the historic distances between the original language and the language you're translating it into. The words are different. Well, that goes without saying, duh. Except that some words change their meaning. Like the word let, if you're familiar with the King James translation, and everybody knows about some of the mistakes that are in the King James translation. Only he who now lets will let. Well, today, when I read the word let, I think that means give permission. But what it meant when it was translated in 1611 was prevent. So it's a word in the English that's completely turned around. It means something almost entirely different than what it meant when it was originally written. We have a vestige of that. If you play ping pong and you serve and it hits the top of the net, they call that a let ball. That's because the net prevented it. So you have to consider words. You have to consider grammar. A lot of grammar changes. And the grammar in English is not like the grammar in Spanish. I know when I took my very limited one college course in Spanish, which, by the way, I took pass-fail and just barely passed, which means I can go see. They do things very differently in Spanish. Sometimes I think it's a good idea they put the question mark at the beginning of the sentence. They also put one at the end, but they put the question mark at the beginning of the sentence so you'll know it's a question mark. So you'll know that sentence is a question. But grammar changes over time. And you have to be aware of grammar because sometimes the apostle, if you read it in the original language, it's not written the way that grammar is generally written. And so what that does is it reaches out and grabs you, and it makes you slow down and read that to make sure that you got the words right because the grammar didn't look right. So if I was describing, for instance, the house that President Trump lives in, we would generally call that the White House. However, if I really wanted to draw attention to something, I might say the house that is white. And you would immediately slow down and pay attention because the grammar is different than what you expected it to be. So when I'm translating the grammar of the original into grammar that we use in English, that causes all kinds of problems. Sometimes you have to be concerned about idioms. An idiom in English is when I say thank you. Those two words just don't mean anything, but it's an idiom. We say it all the time. We know what it means. So it's not the translation of the words. It's the idiom. But sometimes you have to be aware of the idiom. You have to be aware of the culture. And you have to be aware of the history that you're talking about. What were things like then, and what are things like now? So he uses the example of Paul saying, if I give my body to the flames, you know, that makes a lot of sense, and we understand that because we know that Christians were burned at the stake. However, when this was being written, and it was written to a specific group of people, that wasn't something that they commonly saw. He might say, I give my body to hardship. I give my body to to torture, but he wouldn't have said, I give my body to the flames, because it just doesn't fit with the history. That is technically what the words might mean. But when we think about translating it, we know that we can't translate it that way. So, then he talks about, they talk about, three different approaches to translation. And there are three different kinds of equivalence. There's formal equivalence, there's functional equivalence, and there's free translation. So let's consider those for just a minute. Formal equivalence is an attempt to keep as close as possible, as close as you can, to the form of the original. And you write it in English. So it's a literal translation, it's word for word, and it maintains historical distance. In other words, it keeps the form the way it was originally said. Even though that may not make any sense in our language. Often it's hard to read in contemporary English. The King James translation has famously given us some phrases that we just never say. Unless you're a fan of the King James. If you've ever read Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, it's full of King James English. Nobody today ever says 4 score and 70 and 7 years ago. We would say 87 years ago. But that's the King James trying to maintain the form that was in the original and maintain the historic distance. But it's hard to read in contemporary English. Nobody says 4 score and 7 years ago. Nobody says coals of fire. Even though that's the way it was written in the original, we don't say coals of fire. So when you translate it coals of fire, it almost gets in the way of trying to understand what that phrase means. Just like 4 score and 7 years ago can sometimes get in the way of people understanding how long ago it was that the nation was founded when Lincoln was speaking. You see the point? So you have to be careful. Literal translation or formal equivalence translations can be very hard to read. And they can sometimes get in the way. And among the formal translations or formal equivalence translations are the King James translation, the New American Standard, or excuse me, the New King James translation, which unfortunately the King James translation was based on incomplete text. And when they made the New King James, they went back to the incomplete text, even though there were better texts that were available. So they perpetuated the error of the King James text choices, and they got rid of some of the beauty of the language that was in the King James. And so the New King James, I don't find the New King James a very useful translation. The New American Standard Translation tends to be a formal equivalence translation. It's based on some newer evidence than the King James, and it's been revised. It's the Holman Christian Standard Bible, which is a revision of the New American Standard, and the Revised Standard Translation also is a formal equivalence translation, and the Revised Standard was updated to the new Revised Standard Version in 1991. The Revised Standard came out in 1901. The new Revised Standard came out in 1991. Then there's a functional equivalence translation. And here the effort is to take an idea in the original language and translate it into an equivalent idea in the receptor language. So sometimes we call these dynamic translations. They're less concerned with the exact words, less concerned with the exact grammar. They don't preserve the idiomatic expressions, but they give you the idea faithfully translated. And that can be a little bit easier to read, especially for those of us that read English in the 21st century. And you have, in this group, the functional equivalent group, you have the New International Version. The New International Version was translated in, the Old Testament was done in 1973. The New Testament was completed in 1978. And it's based on some of the later texts that were unavailable before that time. So the textual information improved, and it's a slightly different approach to translation. It's a functional equivalence. You have the New American Bible, the NAB, that was translated in 1970, and it was revised into the New Jerusalem Bible. The New Jerusalem Bible was completed in 1985. Then you have the Good News Bible. That came out in 1992. And it was revised into the Revised English Bible in 1999. You have the Jerusalem Bible, 1996. You have the New Living Translation, 1997. So these are some of the equivalents, and some tend to be more literal, some tend to be a little freer. Those that I mentioned first tend to be a little bit more literal. This is all a matter of degree. And then you have some free translations, and the free translations are an attempt to translate intent, not words, not ideas, but the intent of the author. And these can be plagued with problems. You have the New English Bible that was done in 1961, the Living Bible, or it's called the Message sometimes, in 1971, and you have the English Standard Bible that was completed in 2001. I have found reading the English Standard Bible or the English Standard Version to be very informative. I just try to remember that it's a free translation. That's what they think, the translators think the authors meant to say. So when we talk about the problems with different translations, formal equivalence translations, like the King James, for instance, can sometimes give us English that nobody speaks. And it can be hard to read. And if you've ever read the Bible with somebody who's 16 years old, they're not going to understand a lot of the King James translation. They will not get the these and the thous. I understand the royal thee and the royal thou and all of that. That's what the King James was trying to do, but they're just not going to get it. It can make the English ambiguous when the Greek language is really very clear about something. But because we don't have that in our language, it turns out to be ambiguous. And he uses the example of 2 Corinthians 5 at verse 16. Henceforth we know no man after the flesh. Who is doing the knowing? And what does that mean? We know no man after the flesh. So there can be problems with a formal equivalence. And there can be problems with free translation. It can come dangerously close to a commentary where the translator says, this is what I wish had been written, instead of the translator saying, this is what was written. And because it's in the form of the Bible, it kind of shuts down discussion of any other options. So that's a dangerous way to go. Okay. Did I make it clear as mud, or did I help clarify some of that?
Some of it, and I think some of it's like Shakespeare. You don't understand that until you listen and study and see what they're actually doing. And it's kind of like that with the different translations.
Yeah.
It seems like. But you make it clear as almost mud, but better than mud. I got it pretty much.
Hey, if it's clear mud, I'll live with that.
I have a problem with when you were talking way back at the beginning, when you're talking about donkey and cattle instead of young men. It's just as foreseeable as for the history that God is telling them that the kings are going to demand of you the same tribute. Basically, that's what he's saying, the same tribute that I have. You're going to have to do offerings for the first of your crops, for the first of your animals, for the first of your sons. And that's truly the point of it. And when you get down to this first, having the thing about the virgin, the important thing through all of the quotes is if a man thinks he's done something improperly, it's you're straining in a gnat when you talk about, well, is it virgin? Is it his virgin wife before they're married? Is it that they're celibate? The importance of that whole thing is the improper thoughts of the man that he has towards someone. And so then my next question is, this has been an interesting chapter, and you've done a nice job with it, but how are we supposed to use it? Because I can tell you this, there's no person who was ever interested in the Bible that if I tried to tell them this and help them pick out a translation, that they would ever speak to me again, because it's too confusing for anybody who doesn't know the Bible.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. So, how am I going to use this? What I do, because I put myself out there as a teacher, I have to understand this. I have to take the time to understand this. And then I'm going to make a recommendation to somebody. And in general, if I'm studying with somebody, I'm going to give them a Bible. And I'm going to say, this is the Bible we're going to use. So what translation am I going to give them? I give them a New International Translation. Now, that's because I put myself out there as a teacher, and I have to take more time than somebody that I'm just sitting down with studying. So, yes, but you make a very good point. This is not something that you're going to go through with somebody who's just learning about the Bible. I'm not going to talk about this with my 12-year-old grandson.
Okay? But you're trying to teach him salvation, and these other things really don't matter. You can argue over them, but that's not what you teach. You teach Christ. That's what Paul did and Peter and the rest. They taught Christ. And that's what you should just make sure you know what you're talking about, of course. But the other things are nitpicking in a sense, in a very broad sense. But, you know, it makes sense what the book is telling us to look at and be sure we understand. But that's after you're a Christian for 100 years. It takes that long to really get every piece of it.
That's true. That's true. But if you're going to, I still contend, if you're going to be a teacher and you're going to say, this is the best evidence for what this particular passage says, you have to consider all of these things. Now, if you're a learner, do you need to learn some of this? Sure. Sure. And I'm going to tell you, I think that, you know, I could come out here and say, well, hey, read the New International Translation. It's the best one. But I have to tell you why. And I may give you way more information than you ever wanted to know about why. But I have to know if I'm going to give you information. And if you're going to say, read the King James Translation, then you have to know why. And it's not just, hey, that's the one my mama gave me, and so be it, I'm going to read that one. And a lot of people read the King James Translation because that's what they grew up reading. And that's
yeah, but we learn other things beside that. I was too, but there's a lot of things that people don't even read in the King James, and it's so clear. It, well, I guess there's some things I like to study deeper, and it takes more study, of course, but it takes a long time.
You're right. And unless you're, I think Carol makes a really good point, unless you're a man who is engaged and you're trying to work through the relationship that you're going to have with your betrothed, this is not something that you have to be concerned about. I don't worry about that anymore. I'm married, okay? And so that's not a question that would ever arise in my mind. Does it arise in Nolan's mind? Sure. Sure it does. Does a question about a man and his daughter arise in my mind? Not anymore. It did at one time. A man and his daughter, does that arise in Ted's mind? Sure it does. Because he's dealing with Abby. But until these questions are particularly salient in your life, you're just not going to look at them. You're not going to spend the time to try to understand them.
I think one of the important things that maybe we can figure out is just because I've been studying in the NIV and that I know it really well and it makes sense to me, I mean, it really would be nice to know what kind of translation is going to make sense to the young people. And if I have to have, if I need to be able to read that and explain that to them from the version that I'm reading, that's the thing that I can see that's helpful, if we can come across what is the kind of best one to have the kids, the young people now listen to.
Well, there are specific translations that are geared to specific groups. There is a translation that was prepared for the deaf community. I'll take that back. It was prepared for young readers, okay? And young readers have a much more limited vocabulary. So when they prepared this translation, they did it using a vocabulary of only about 3,000 words. Well, it turns out that if you're talking to someone in the deaf community, they have a similarly limited vocabulary. And that's a very good translation to use if you're talking to someone in the deaf community. All of one of the things about manual language is the grammar never changes. It's always noun, verb. Okay? It never changes. And if you read through just about any translation, like I said, sometimes the writer will throw in a twist in the grammar and it catches your thinking and causes you to stop and say, what's going on here? You can't do that with the deaf community. It won't make any, it won't work in that community. So you have to use noun, verb. And that's what this translation does. Everything is noun, verb. And if I was talking to an English language learner, and I did that quite a bit when I was a school psychologist, I learned that you always had to write everything noun, verb. You can't change things up to catch their eye and impress them with how important this is, because they won't understand it. So everything has to be noun, verb. So you make a very good point, Carol, that knowing about these translations, being familiar with them, can help us to choose the best translation to use when we're talking to a specific group of people.
The Spanish threw the verb before the noun to it, and it's turned around. The verb comes first, and the emphasis is on different ones. You're right, absolutely.
Yeah, my dad used to say you put the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Yeah, that's right.
and you got the words right, but you, because of the way you emphasize, and I'll tell you what, I was listening to Hamilton. I don't know if anybody else watched Hamilton on reruns on the Disney Plus channel, but I was listening to Hamilton, and I have such a hard time understanding rap because the syntax is all wrong. It just doesn't fit my ear, and I have to listen so hard to try to figure out what they're saying.
And it's so fast.
And it's fast as well. Okay. But now I'm not going to tell you I know of a translation that was written in rap. I don't know that's like that. But somebody will probably put one together. Okay? So anytime you're talking to somebody, I'm convinced that you can bring somebody to a knowledge of God with a poor translation. You may have to work a little bit harder to get there, but you can bring somebody to know God, even from a poor translation. With a good translation, it helps. But spend some time thinking about the translation that you're going to use. And if you're interested, take a course in textual criticism. You know, you can sign up for online courses, and you can do that. And it's a fascinating study. You know, we've only just barely scratched the surface of textual criticism here. And translation and theories of translation. Those are a lot more complicated than what I presented here. So we've gone
complicated enough.
It is complicated. We've gone over time, and I apologize for that. But we need to bring this to a conclusion. And we can consider this again next week. Now, next week we'll start talking about epistles, and we'll talk about some of the specific rules that we need to apply to understanding epistle. And when we say epistles, those are basically the letters that are in the New Testament. Any other thoughts that anybody has before we get away?
I appreciate your teaching, though. That really helped. It helped me. It's still, I have some questions that even you can't answer. Well, you know, I'm just funny that way, but I thought you did very well.
That there is no question that you probably have questions that I can't answer.
Well, I can't answer them either, so.
Okay. See you all Sunday morning for our Zoom worship. And everybody feel bad for Carolyn. She went to Mount Pisgah and got her car broken into.
Oh.
Yeah, so that stinks. You ought to be able to go out and enjoy the outdoors without somebody breaking the window in your car and stealing your purse. But
what is the subject for the Sunday evening class?
Ron signed off already. It'll be Judges, the next section. We did up through, Deborah's song in the fifth chapter. So we'll begin in chapter 6. That's what I'm thinking. I think Ron signed off already, so I'm not sure. But
yeah,
I'm sorry, Lenny.
I think you're right. He's going to start chapter 6.
And I would read 3 or 4 chapters right there.